a compliment. Okay. Today, I'd like to preach to you all on the subject of purity. It is a great goal, purity, but it is not one we can achieve ourselves. Only by allowing the smiling God to devour us do we achieve the purity that it demands from us. She clicked a remote, and the projector bulb flipped on, shining a blank square of light against the screen. "Oh, dang it, hold on," she said. "It always takes a moment to warm up. You would think one of these days I would figure that out." The congregation laughed just long enough to acknowledge the joke, but not so long that the laughter became about her troubles with the projector. It was a finely tuned laugh, based on years of respect and awe. A strange illustration appeared on the screen, along with the caption, "Skin is a necessary evil." "There we go," said the pastor. "Now, purity." 22. Skin is a necessary evil. Purity is not a state of mind. It is not a physical state. It is not even a spiritual state. There are no elements to it. You cannot piece together purity. Purity is a state of entire existence. It is an unbroken thing and cannot be received in fractions. We must be made pure in one big gulp, swallowed whole. Joyfully, it devours. Change is constant and final. There is no reversal. We must give ourselves over to change, the way that we give ourselves to the smiling God. Both will devour us. The process may not be pleasant, but pleasant isn't everything. A life that was merely pleasant would be a failure of a life. After all, you have been condemned to death. Your crime is birth. There is no appeal possible. Everything you eat is sunlight made physical. You are radiant and forever. Try to remember what you look like. Hope is the most powerful force in the universe. Besides time, tectonic shifts, volcanoes, acid, and certain shocks, steel is also more powerful. It can hold up buildings. Can hope hold up buildings? Unfortunately, no. Disease is also more powerful. No one was ever cured through hope. Despair is sometimes more powerful. That is entirely up to you. How much weight you give to hope and how much to despair cannot change much in the way of outcomes. But it will change your experience of those outcomes completely. A scientific fact. Most things aren't. Most events haven't. When considering our place in the universe, we must recognize that by having this one position, we are negating every other possible position we could have. There is no gain without loss. There is no stance we can take that isn't denying every other stance we could have taken. Every sunrise we see is a dream we miss. Every trip of a lifetime is that much less of a lifetime spent comfortably at home. Once we accept loss, we have the key to accepting everything else. Your heartbeat is approximate. The moon is not our enemy. It is our friend. Please do not attack or provoke the moon. Make no mistake. Do not seek purity. Wait for it. accept it. You are not made holy by your actions, but by your acceptance of the actions of the world. Once you are in tune with those, once you recognize the sacred plan in all that happens to you, you will be ready to enter into the plan of purity, of holiness. And in entering this, you will truly be joyous. And then you will truly be a member of the joyous congregation of the smiling God. The ceremony of the devouring will honor purity by calling the smiling God from its glorious home to our congregation and our world. Out in the desert is a road built by no one. Its black top is cracked, its paint faded. You will walk it one day. It goes nowhere. Amen. The pastor finished, recontextualizing everything she had said before this as a prayer. Amen. The congregation responded, accepting this recontextualization. Now, Gordon, please lead us in another joyous song. Gordon did, with an accordion this time. Sing, sing, sing. Give a joyous shout. For the ground below us is about to give out. And from deep underground comes a hungry mouth. Sing, sing, sing. Give a joyous shout. Hypothesis. The church plans to summon something from the other world. Evidence. They basically said so in the sermon with the insinuation that there would be a ceremony of devouring. What Nilanjana didn't know was how they would achieve it, or even if a summoning was a real thing that could be carried out. Stephanie nudged her, and she realized that she was the only one in the room not singing. No headpiece would hide a lack of participation. She did her best to hum along, but then decided that that was bringing more attention to herself. And what would she do when the service started to wrap up? Surely there was small talk. Most situations that don't involve scripted actions involve small talk. She wasn't great at small talk in the best of situations, and pretending to be a man she barely knew was, if not the worst of situations, close to it. Swallow, 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 swallow. Swallow, 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 swallow. Gulp, 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 gulp. Yeah. Swallow, swallow, swallow. Yeah. Gordon finished with an unnecessary flourish of the accordion, and the pastor forgave it with a beatific smile. And now, she said, let's have some testimonials. Who will go first? This seemed to involve individual audience participation, and while there were a lot of people in the room, there weren't so many that Nilanjana could feel safely lost in the crowd. Let's hear from Martin first, the pastor said. One of the interchangeable robed and headpieced figures hopped up enthusiastically and jogged to the podium. Hey, gang, he said. I'm Martin McCaffrey. As most of you know, I used to run TSA out at the Nightvale Airport. I wasn't happy with my career. The hours were long. The pay was unrewarding. I continuously made drawings of an elongated dark figure, and I had no memory of making them. One day, I had had enough, and I set traps all over my house to catch whatever demon or evil force was haunting my life. Sacrificed mice at tiny altars in order to gain protection. Built a complex machine that predicted the future by murdering wasps. The whole deal. I guess you could call it a midlife crisis. But was I happy? I was not. I only thought I was happy because of how many animal sacrifices I had made. It wasn't until I ran into May over there. Hi, May. And she told me about the devouring mercy of the smiling God that I saw the truth. I couldn't fight the demon on my own. I needed an even larger, more terrifying force on my side. It has been amazing getting to know all of you over the past couple of years, and my new job overseeing the summer camp counselors is rewarding in a way that the airport thing never was. It pays way less, though. Way less. Would love to talk about the compensation plan with someone. But other than that, it's perfect. Thanks to all of you for being a community who supports each other. Thank you to Pastor Munn for all that you give us. Thank you to May, again. Wouldn't have gotten here without May. She's a real pal. And thank you to the smiling God for devouring our sins with its great and holy maw. Oh boy, just love that smiling God. Amen, said the pastor, now using the word as a signal that it was time for Martin to stop talking. He twirled his fist in the air, nodded at the pastor, and went back to his seat. What a wonderful testimony Martin gave us, the pastor said. Thank you for giving us the gift of your experiences. Now, who would like to go next? Who can speak on the power of the smiling God? Many hands went up. It seemed that all of them could speak on the power of the smiling God. Nilanjana didn't know whether it would be better to put her hand up or stay as she was and risk being singled out as the only non-participant. She settled on nodding enthusiastically, as though she totally agreed with how much everyone wanted to get up there and talk. Great job, everyone, her bouncing head said. But it didn't matter. The pastor glanced at the room briefly before settling her eyes on Nilanjana. It felt as though she could see through the headpiece. Daryl, she said, or should I say, the wordsmith, always so eloquent about the joy you find in this community. Please, share one or two of those wonderful words with all of us. Nilanjana swore there was something mocking in the pastor's tone of voice, although no one else in the room seemed to notice. There was an enthusiastic cheer. Daryl was well-liked here. Would that make it better or worse when they caught her? Her mouth was dry, and her stomach was making moves. The figure on the other side of Stephanie stood up. I would like to share a testimony. It was Jamila. Nilanjana could see the tip of a power drill hanging down from one of the long sleeves of her robe. Sit down, Jamila, the pastor snapped, and Jamila immediately did. Get up here, Daryl. Don't turn shy now. Speak from the teeth. Pastor Munn knew. Everyone in the room was looking at what they thought was Daryl. Where was he? Even if he was watching, was there anything he could do to help her? Maybe she shouldn't have trusted him at all. Her stomach lurched. The back of her neck dripped sweat. The pastor made a commanding gesture with her arm, and Stephanie pushed Nilanjana on the shoulder. What are you doing? Stephanie whispered. You can't ignore the pastor. Nilanjana went through her options. One, of course, was to allow herself to be caught. After all, under Nightvale law, what could they do to her? She had not violated any civic code, federal law, or mandate of the secret world government. She'd have to check, but she was pretty sure that even the ancient laws of the lizard people who run all human government had nothing to say about sneaking into a religious service. On the other hand, it didn't seem like a great idea to be caught by a group that had just been singing about a god eating them. She could run, of course. There were few situations in which one could not just start running. Although the consequences of this action varied quite a bit, and in some situations could include exiting a moving car, being mauled by a bear, or falling off a tightrope. On top of that, the impulse when someone runs is to chase, and that was not an impulse she wanted to ignite in this group. But she had to do something, and quite quickly. because the decision was about to be made for her. The moment she opened her mouth, it would be over. The moment she opened her mouth, she knew what she had to do. She swayed dramatically. She put one hand on her stomach, and then she opened her mouth. "Oh, no," said Jamila. The pastor's face radiated anger and disgust. Gordon pulled off his headpiece, revealing his sweaty and worried face. "Daryl, are you okay, son?" he said. Nilanjana stood with the vomit still dribbling down the yellow robe from underneath the yellow mesh mask. With the fear pulsing in her gut, it had been easy to intentionally retrieve her breakfast. She gave a loud moan in the lowest tone she could muster, and then, hand still on stomach, she stumbled out of the room. In the lobby, she figured she had only seconds, and so she opened the door to one of the bathrooms, set the doorknob lock, slammed the door shut, and continued down the hall toward the church offices. Behind her, she could hear Gordon's concerned voice. "Daryl? Son? Are you all right in there?" Hopefully, it would take them some time before their worry about Daryl outweighed their feelings about privacy. She pulled off her mask and stuck her head in and out of empty office after office until she found Daryl in the pastor's office at the bookshelves. His eyes went scared and wide on seeing her. "What are you doing here?" he said. "Is the service over? Where do they think I am?" She said. "And what is that all over my robe?" "I can explain all of that when we're not in a place where we might be caught. Are those books about what the church is planning?" "No," he said. "It's just the history of the church. We're not allowed to read this stuff normally, so I couldn't resist." More shouting from the lobby. More knocking on the bathroom door. "I'm glad you're indulging your rebellious side, but we need to be looking for evidence of contact with the other world." He held up a stack of papers. "I found these. The service wasn't anywhere near done, so I thought I had time to check out the books." She took the papers from him and looked them over. It was page after page of handwritten text, apparently notes taken while studying. The word invocation occurred over and over, always in the same all caps, thick-lined style. "Invocation?" she said. "Is that the ceremony of devouring she mentioned in her sermon?" The knocking got heavier, edging toward pounding. The shouting sounded less worried, more angry. This was taking too long. "I've never heard of the term, but it does look like it's some kind of ceremony. If I'm understanding these documents correctly, it seems like it will be happening in the next week or so, and uses something called the Book of Devouring, which I also haven't heard of and can't find anywhere on these shelves." Daryl shook his head. "None of this makes any sense to me. This isn't the religion I grew up with." "They certainly were talking a lot about devouring during the service." "But that's all metaphor and parable. This is... I don't know what this is. I want to help you figure it out." Now the bathroom door was being rattled. They were trying to open it. "I have to get out of here," Nilanjana said. "Give me the papers and take this robe. You're going to need the vomit on it. Also a good excuse for why you just puked and pretended to hide in the bathroom." "Why I did what? I'll meet you at the car." She darted out of the pastor's office and deeper down the hall, assuming there would have to be some sort of exit back there, but she couldn't find one. Behind her, the bathroom door banged open and the shouting intensified. It would be ideal if she were not here anymore, but the world is rarely ideal. Giving up on a door, she opened a window and awkwardly squeezed out of it onto the drought-resistant shrubs outside. Scraped from the branches and finding a leaf in her hair, she jogged a ways into the parking lot before cutting back to the sidewalk and heading toward the car. As she was stepping into the street, a hand fell on her shoulder. "We need to talk with you." The hand belonged to a security guard from the Joyous Congregation. He squinted at her under the blaring sun and over a thick mustache. I am on a public street. You can't just grab me. You have no right to make me go anywhere. And you, he said, snatching the bundle of invocation papers out of her bag, have no right to take church property. Come quietly. We don't need to call the secret police. The pastor only wants to talk. 24. The woman in the huge rectangular hat smiled at Nilanjana. Gordon, standing behind her, crossed his arms and bared his teeth while stretching his lips wide. It was not a smile at all. It was a grotesque and off-putting expression, and Nilanjana did not know what to make of it. She glanced at Daryl, but he was not looking at her, only at the pastor. "My, what a lovely day this is," the pastor said. Her voice was gentle but insincere, like the wolf dressed up as the grandmother in the fairy tale. All of the stagecraft of kindness, but nothing at the heart of it. "A great day," said Gordon, his bizarre grimace even wider than before. "And why is it a great day, Gordon?" the pastor said. "It's great because, well, his stretched lips faltered. "It's great because we have a new visitor, someone who doesn't know our faith. And she has come to learn from us. That's a blessing, isn't it, Gordon?" "It is," he said, relieved to be on more certain ground. "Isn't it, Daryl?" she said. Daryl looked surprised to be addressed. "Yes, Pastor," he said. "We want to thank you, Daryl," the pastor said. "We as a community owe you gratitude. And I, as an individual, want you to know that I am thankful for bringing this woman into our services, this curious, curious woman."
"Curiosity killed the cat," said Gordon.
Nilanjana glared at Daryl. He winked without smiling. Was that supposed to mean, "I got you," as in he betrayed her, or "I got you," as in he was on her side? "I know what you are doing," Nilanjana said, tired of the games the pastor was playing, and wanted to get this confrontation going. As a scientist, she did not have much interest in games, except science games, like, "Is that beaker going to explode?" and "Will this catch on fire if exposed to oxygen?" The answer to both questions was almost always yes. The pastor took off her hat. Underneath, she looked like a normal person. A person wearing a golden robe and a huge golden medallion in the shape of a sun, with some horrible creature wrapped around it. "I find that hard to believe, Miss Sikdar, because the fact of the matter is that you don't even know what you are doing. You are flailing in the dark and hoping you will simply run into the truth. Am I wrong or am I right?"
"Wrong or right, interloper," Gordon shouted.
It had been a while since Nilanjana had felt the insulting force of that word. Like Carlos had said, she had started getting used to it as a friendly utterance around town by strangers or, at worst, a dismissive grumble. But Gordon put her back in her place as an outsider.
"Gordon, she doesn't need to answer me, because I already know the answer. While you are in the dark, Nilanjana Sikdar, we in the congregation live always in the light. In this situation, I am the one who knows things. You are the one who does not. Tell me I'm wrong."
"You're wrong."
Pastor Munn wasn't wrong. Nilanjana was just guessing. But her gut told her it was a pretty good guess.
"Your church started when you made contact with the desert otherworld," Nilanjana hazarded. "Your people found something there, a powerful creature, and you started worshipping it as a god."
These were unsupported hypotheses, baseless allegations. Carlos would be so disappointed.
But perhaps saying them aloud might bring real evidence out in conversation. And now it's attacking Night Vale, hurting people, killing them, she continued. Maybe you are helping it, or baiting it to come closer. Or maybe you are just trying to hinder anyone who wants to stop it. The effect is the same either way. You are to blame for what is happening. Tell me I'm wrong. The pastor considered her. Gordon started to shout some variation on how dare you, but the pastor held up a finger, and he fell silent. Daryl waved to get Nilanjana's attention, but she kept her eyes on the pastor. The smiling god, the pastor said, is coming to swallow Night Vale. It will devour all of us. Daryl waved again, and Nilanjana gave in and looked. He winked at her. She had no idea what that meant and wished he would stop winking. So you are admitting to everything I just said, she said. It will take all of us inside its body, the pastor said. We will enter the divine mouth and be consumed. Daryl winked again. Nilanjana couldn't understand what he was trying to convey. He didn't seem triumphant or devious. He just seemed like a guy who was winking for some reason. It's a metaphor, Nilanjana, Daryl interjected, realizing his winking wasn't being understood. I know some of this devouring talk can sound scary to newcomers, like we're trying to get everyone eaten by a monster. But it's a beautiful metaphor about how the smiling god will devour us and, in doing so, take in everything that's bad about us. It's a story about the church accepting all people, no matter who they are. A metaphor? Maybe a violent-sounding metaphor, Daryl shrugged apologetically. But its meaning is nice, right? A metaphor? She asked again, this time to the pastor. The pastor was looking at Daryl with an expression that could have been pitiful benevolence or quiet disgust. No, the pastor said, her smile now a scowl. No, said Daryl. Absolutely not, said Gordon. His face had gone red. Why would we deal in metaphors? We are the faithful in the house of the smiling god. Daryl, I thought better of you. Wait, Daryl said, but the entire faith is built around the story of the smiling god devouring our sins, all of our failings, leaving us pure. It's not real in a historical sense, obviously, but it imbues real meaning into our lives. No, Daryl, the pastor said. She sounded sad. I'm sorry that the church failed in its teaching. I'm sure your scientist friend would agree. Why would anyone want to live in fiction? Nilanjana surely understands. She lives a life of hard facts. We too believe in the concrete reality of our spiritual life. The smiling god is a real, physical thing. It is coming to swallow all of Night Vale. What does that even mean? Daryl said. How can the smiling god swallow anything? Ah, that part is easy, the pastor said. Gordon, tell him. Gordon straightened with pride. Because, he shouted, the smiling god is a centipede. Yes, exactly, the pastor said. It's a giant centipede. It lives in heaven, and it will soon swallow us all. What? Daryl said. I knew it, Nilanjana said. I'm sorry, I thought we were pretty clear about this. There's one right on our door. Also overlooking the worship hall. The purpose of the joyous congregation is to summon a giant centipede and have it eat the entire world. Why? Nilanjana and Daryl asked simultaneously. Why? Gordon mocked. Joyfully it devours, the needlework on the wall said. The pastor frowned. Did you sleep through my sermon? Or were you too busy plotting ways to fail to fool us? Purity! The world is an unjust and impure place. By devouring the rich and the poor, the sinful and the saint, by devouring without discrimination, the smiling God will purify the world. This is not something we inflict on others. We, the faithful, will be the first to be eaten, followed shortly by all other people.
Daryl stood up. I grew up in this church, and I went to all of the services and all of the classes. And you're telling me that all of that, every moment of every year, was to get a huge centipede to eat the town?
Gordon stared him down.
Young man, he said, please watch your tone when you are speaking to your church elders. We know what is best for you. What's best for you is that you get eaten by just a great big centipede.
We are a community, Daryl said, of people who will be eaten by a giant bug.
Yes, the pastor said. I'm getting tired of explaining this.
Are you putting out bait? Nilanjana asked, wanting to finally get hard facts for her research. Or using some sort of broadcast frequencies to agitate it? How are you getting it to attack us?
We haven't done anything yet, the pastor said. I don't know about any attacks. What the smiling God does on its own time is its own divine business. No, soon we will do a ceremony, a great ceremony that will summon our smiling God. It's all in the notes you tried to steal. You can't have them because they belong to me. But allow me to summarize for you. The smiling God will be called to rise from the sand and eat everything it sees.
Not if I stop you, said Nilanjana, a not wise thing to say, but she wasn't wise, just brilliant.
Gordon laughed.
Stop us, the pastor said. She held out her palms. How would you stop us? We are what is supposed to happen. Do you stop rain? Do you stop earthquakes?
Yes, Nilanjana said. She did not personally do that, but of course all weather and earthquakes were now controlled by NASA, so she was speaking with the collective we of all scientists.
Ah, the pastor said. In that case, if you try to stop us, we will destroy you utterly. We will destroy you so completely that even the traces of the life you've lived thus far will be gone. Your friends won't remember you, even as they breathe in microscopic dust that used to be your body.
She beamed.
I do hope you have a blessed day. May the smiling God be with you until it is actually with you very soon.
And Daryl, she said, turning back to him, we want to thank you.
We do, said Gordon, then regaining his utter confidence. We do. Thank you, Daryl.
We want to thank you for uncovering this possible plot against our church and bringing Miss Sikdar to us. It's so nice to have this time to clear the air with you, Miss Sikdar. We couldn't have done it without Daryl.
And what exactly did he do? Nilanjana asked, looking right at Daryl.
What he's supposed to, said Gordon. He is a good boy.
Nilanjana, listen to me, said Daryl. You know me. Everything I told you was true. I didn't know this would happen.
But did she know him?
Of course she didn't. She knew what he presented to the world. She knew how his hands felt, what the sweat on his neck smelled like. But that wasn't knowing someone. A hand on her shoulder again, the mustachioed guard. She cried out.
Don't worry, said the pastor. We won't harm you. The smiling God will do that for us. But it is time for you to go.
Nilanjana, please believe me, Daryl said, but the pastor motioned him sharply down, and he seemed unable to disobey her. Nilanjana was pulled out of her chair and pushed roughly through a door, and then a hallway, and then another door.
She felt the gradients of air conditioning as she moved from deep inside the building toward the windows of the lobby. And then one last door, and she was in the heat of the afternoon.
"You have a good day now," the guard said.
"Where is Daryl?"
If he hadn't betrayed her, then he could be in danger from the church. Who knew what they would do to him? If he had betrayed her, she wanted to put him in danger herself.
The guard did the weird teeth thing, a child's accidentally terrifying drawing of a smile. "He is where he is supposed to be. He is with the community that loves him. It is time for you to go."
She turned, starting the long walk back to her apartment. She was already thirsty, and she knew that this feeling would get worse every minute of walking in the searing heat.
"I'll be seeing you," said the guard.
She would be seeing him, too. For the next few minutes, every time she closed her eyes, she saw the ghost image of his teeth under his large, unkempt mustache projected in neon against the insides of her lids. Back in the church, in one of the small classrooms, Martin McCaffrey met with his summer camp planning committee. They brainstormed themes for next year's camp: This Mortal Soil, and A Bug's Afterlife, and Centipede Cotillion were the front runners. He ate chicken salad with the group and wrote out a to-do list, which included calling to recruit potential volunteers. Later, he would go home and reheat the soup he'd made the day before and watch television news. He didn't enjoy watching the news. He just didn't know how to turn his television off or to a different station. He still saw elongated dark figures in the corners of his home and outside his windows. They lurked behind the news anchors on the television. When he reheated his soup, he saw one in the reflection of the microwave window reaching out a spindly arm. Each time he would scream and clutch his chest, and each time he would forget seeing them a moment later. Martin felt great stress without understanding why. He tried to calm himself by returning to his longtime passion of drawing and painting, but the figures showed up repeatedly in his work. The drawings disturbed him. He threw them away, disgusted by his own efforts. One day, 3 years after the day he ate chicken salad and planned a summer camp, a year and a half after he left the church because it ultimately had failed to help him with his problem, he'd accidentally left one of these drawings on the table instead of throwing it away. When he encountered it again a few days later, he found it less disturbing, perhaps even aesthetically interesting. He hung it up and intentionally made more. Elongated dark specters covering the page. He hung them all up. He grew to like them. His walls papered in landscapes and bowl of fruit still lifes, all with long, human-like forms in the backgrounds. He no longer felt the same stress. He no longer saw these lurking figures in his real life, although, since he did not remember ever seeing them, he did not consciously recognize the change. He simply noticed feeling more energy, more joy in life. He attributed this change to exercise and a series of books on self-confidence he was reading, but the effect of those was incidental. He rarely left his home. In narrow hallways cluttered with horrifying drawings, Martin would feel as happy as he had ever felt. 25. Carlos would know what to do, and he would also have to admit that infiltrating the church had been the correct next move, no matter how unscientific it had been. He was attending Big Rico's Pizza's grand reopening, so Nilanjana left her apartment to meet him there. She changed out of her sweaty clothes, got in her car, and put the air conditioning on full blast. Trying to get the strong possibility that Daryl had betrayed her out of her head, Nilanjana switched on her car radio. Community radio was important in Night Vale. Cecil Palmer, regular radio host and, of course, handsome husband Carlos, served as a voice of the community, informing them, but also expressing their fears and grievances and joys, so that everyone could share in them. He was in the middle of a news report when she turned the radio on. City Hall announced plans to expand the rec center to include a secret survival bunker, a secondary, even more secret bunker, two helipads for quick evacuations, and a children's playroom. Children will not be allowed in the playroom so that they will not block evacuation routes to the bunkers or helipads. As well as a traffic report, which was a series of sonnets about a rhinoceros who liked kites. Just as she was arriving at the shopping center, Cecil got to the weather. The weather report was Sturgill Simpson's song, Turtles All the Way Down, which was a popular cover of the Canadian National Anthem. The weather reports on the radio were never that informative about the weather, but they were super informative about life. She stepped into the rare afternoon rain, unpredicted by the radio's weather report, and walked toward the giant pit in the ground that once was Big Rico's Pizza. The remaining employees were standing around the top of the pit, working under the worried and watchful eye of Arnie Goldblum. Arnie was feeling a lot of pressure, trying to honor the legacy of his brother. Plus, people kept thinking that this would be the perfect time to catch their mailman, and he had explained over and over that he wasn't carrying the mail with him today. The establishment had technically reopened, but none of the walls or counters had been rebuilt, and no new cooking equipment or appliances purchased. There were no tables or chairs or self-serve soft drink machines, just a deep pit in the earth, with dozens of people milling around the edge holding out their hands as if supporting plates. They were lifting their other hands to their mouths and chewing on nothing, saying things like, "It's as good as it ever was," and "Delicious, so glad Rico's is back," and "Oh, I burned my mouth eating this scrumptious pizza too quickly," and then fanning their empty mouths. Nilanjana could not determine if they were pretending to eat pizza in order to make Arnie feel better, or if Arnie had staged this scene with friends in order to drum up publicity, or if perhaps he was making invisible slices. The Moonlight All-Night Diner served invisible pie, so it seemed plausible that Arnie was getting in on the invisible food movement. It was a popular fad, because it required almost no preparation to take a photo for social media of your own home-cooked invisible food. And so these days, everyone's timeline was full of pictures of empty plates with proud captions like, "Homemade invisible black bean chili. Healthy, delicious, and totally real." "Hey, Nils," Carlos stepped up beside her. He was holding out a non-existent plate in one hand. His other hand was positioned like it was holding a slice of pizza. "This is way easier to eat than the old globs of cheese and sauce with no crust." "Carlos, I have to talk to you," she said. "I learned what the church is..." "Are you actually eating an invisible pizza or just pretending?" "I have no idea, but play along. Arnie's having a tough go right now." A man in a flannel shirt came by and slapped Carlos on the back.
"Oh, howdy there, Carlos. This pizza sure is powerful tasty," said the man. He nodded at Nilanjana. "Hi there, I'm John Peters. You know, the farmer."
"I know," she said. John Peters had been the one to start the invisible food movement. He had the unenviable position of acting as a farmer in a desert. This is a common plight. Many of the nation's crops are grown in corners of California that would be, without the steady flow of federal water, barren plains. Pour enough water on anything and it'll deliver food eventually. The problem for John Peters was that Night Vale's relationship with the federal government was shaky at best, given that it mostly failed to appear on national maps or censuses, and that the reality of Night Vale and the reality of the rest of the country did not seem to line up exactly. This meant that John's requests for canals or water deliveries from the government were often treated as hoaxes or filing errors by the officials who received them. So John's land stayed dry and empty. Then he came up with his most inspired idea. He announced that he had planted invisible corn and invited fellow town members to come and look at his empty fields, which were where he said the invisible corn was coming up nicely. Soon he put up a farm stand, selling his invisible corn to excited foodies eager to try this new variety. The Moonlight All-Night Diner started selling invisible corn muffins made from the invisible corn, and when those did well, they added invisible pie to the menu. After that, invisible food was everywhere. Nilanjana had been part of the team that Carlos sent to investigate John's claims about his crops. Their conclusion, a common one in science, was that looking into it too deeply would spoil the fun. "We've met," Nilanjana said.
"I don't think so. Anyway, I'd shake your hand, but mine is all covered with invisible pizza grease right now."
John held up his perfectly clean hand and shrugged.
"What's your name?"
"Nilanjana. We've met."
"Nice to meet you, Niljona."
He smiled in a distant way and walked on, cradling his invisible or imaginary slice in both hands.
"I've met him so many times," she said to Carlos. Maybe she should reopen their investigation into his invisible corn.
"Sometimes I wonder if he always reminds us he's a farmer because even he has trouble remembering," Carlos said.
"Can we go talk somewhere?" she said,
but his gaze went over her shoulder and his face brightened.
"Oh, Abby, Steve, over here!"
Abby Palmer waved back and headed their way with her husband, Steve Carlsberg, and their teenage daughter, Janice. Abby was Cecil's sister, and Janice was Carlos's favorite and only niece.
"Uncle Carlos!"
Janice said, wheeling her chair over toward him.
"How's my young scientist?"
Carlos dropped to one knee. Janice grimaced.
"I don't like science," she said. "I want to be a professional athlete."
"But athletics is science," Carlos said. "All that movement is physics. And sports that involve test tubes, like golf or water polo, are especially scientific. Here, I have a chart." The chart was a piece of paper that had a picture of a basketball and the words, "sports equals science."
"The data is irrefutable," he said.
She laughed and he smiled, happy to have gotten the laugh from her.
"I heard your game on Friday went well." "We crushed the Pine Cliff Lizard Monitors. I think we might make state if anyone can figure out where that is and how we would get there from Nightvale. Leaving Nightvale's hard."
"It is." Nilanjana felt a pang of homesickness for her family back in Indiana. She still went and visited them when she could, which wasn't often because, again, leaving Nightvale is difficult. It was also difficult to explain her job to people not from Nightvale. Anytime she told them what was happening there, they thought she was making fun of them. And because time doesn't work in Nightvale, she was never certain at what point in their lives she would arrive. Once, she came home for Diwali to find that her mother was 6 years old, and her father was nowhere to be found, since he didn't move to the United States until he was 17. She played with the little girl that was her mother, the little girl that would grow up to be a chemistry professor, and the main driving force for Nilanjana's fascination with the wonder of science. She remembered her mother teaching her about negative numbers when Nilanjana was only 6, and how proud she had been to learn mathematics that seemed to belong to older people. And so she asked her 6-year-old mother about negative numbers and listened to her mother chatter away about everything she knew on the subject as they sat on a park bench under the drifting fall leaves. Then she went back to Nightvale, and the next time she visited her parents, they were, more or less, the correct age. She had never dared ask her mother if she remembered meeting a visitor in a park when she was 6. "You're lucky to have your family so close around you," Nilanjana said to Janice.
"I know,"
Janice beamed. "Now, I'm sorry, I just have to borrow your uncle for one moment, because I need to talk to him about something important."
"I love her," Carlos said as Nilanjana led him away. "You never think about a spouse's family when you're looking for the right person, but especially being from out of town. None of my own family is anywhere nearby, and so they've become my family here. It makes a difference, having family around."
Nilanjana felt another pang, but ignored it.
"I did what I told you I was going to do," she said. "I snuck into the church, and then I got caught. But it worked out. Long story."
Carlos widened his eyes at something over her shoulder.
No, Carlos, listen. I know there's lots of people to say hello to here, but I need to talk to you about what the church is planning.
Carlos pointed at whatever he was looking at. She sighed.
We can go chat with whoever it is as soon as we're done here. Just give me 5 minutes. The smiling God is real. It's real, and it's...
She trailed off as she became aware of the hissing, like static from a badly tuned radio. But somehow the noise of it made a physical bubbling on her skin. It was awful. She started to turn, and Carlos stopped her.
Act natural. Look into my eyes, he said as he put on reflective sunglasses. Don't turn around.
She saw the bronzy, warped mirror of her own face on each lens. She saw behind her a deep pit surrounded by people, each tiny and curved in the reflective lenses, each standing in silent horror. And she saw behind them the row of figures in long cloaks and hoods. There were no faces visible in the hoods. People began to run. Janice usually moved herself around, but Steve got behind her wheelchair and sprinted them away. Abby right after them. The hooded figures were a common sight in Nightvale, but no one knew who they were. They mostly gathered around the municipal dog park, which was forbidden to enter. No one knew if the dog park was off-limits because of the hooded figures, or if the hooded figures gathered there because it was off-limits. An intern from the radio station had entered the dog park a few years back, and had walked and walked through its seemingly limitless interior until she had found herself in a vast desert surrounding a single mountain. Through this, Carlos learned that the dog park, like the house that doesn't exist, was a gateway to the other desert world. The hooded figures often made a sound like static. No one had ever seen their faces. If anyone was foolish enough to walk home alone at night, they were often tailed at a distance of one block by a hooded figure, who would stumble and lurch as though drunk, but would move with a directed purpose after their target. Most people made it home and locked their doors and stayed out of sight of windows for a while. Some did not make it home. Those who were caught by a hooded figure were never seen again, not by human eyes. John Peters froze, feeling a terror hold his body in place. The hooded figures had become a problem for him after the planting of his invisible corn. Or maybe just planting, no scare quotes. The entire invisible food movement had caught on so strongly that even he was unsure if the corn was real or not. Soon after the announcement of that first crop, he started to find, after the sun went down, hooded figures wandering his property. They would walk slowly through the fields, moving their hands as though pushing aside stalks of corn. He refused to go outside after dark, and eventually to even be in the dark in his own home. He slept with the lights on, wearing a sleep mask so that he could approximate a normal sleep cycle. But the thin band of light where the mask met his nose reminded him of his fear, which reminded him of the strange figures stalking through crops that weren't there, which reminded him that he was only able to plant invisible crops, which reminded him of his failure as, you know, a farmer. He would lie, wide-eyed and awake, staring into the fabric of his mask, until the light changed around his nose and he knew that it was dawn. The figures formed a circle around the pit. Carlos and Nilanjana hurried after the crowd, slipping away from the pit through a gap in the circle. The static was deafening and painful. The figures' hoods billowed in the wind, but the darkness beneath them was complete and unchanging. John Peters finally tried to run, but all gaps were gone. He backed away until there was no more ground left, and then fell into the soft dirt below, still alive with worms. There was no way out of the pit. He was the only one left. There was a high-pitched sound, like a kitten's mewl, elongated and looped. The hooded figures stood, cloak to cloak, so the world outside the pit was no longer visible. And then the figures began to violently shake. They shook and shook. John Peters curled into a ball against the squirming soil and hoped, best case scenario, that he would just be killed.
26. Nilanjana didn't like John Peters at all, but she wasn't going to stand by as a person got taken by the hooded figures. Carlos was pulling her away, intent on his mission of survival, but she shook away his grasp and ran back toward the pit. Nilanjana, what are you doing? Good question. There was no gap in the ring around the pit, so, without giving herself time to assess the data and come up with a plan, she charged headlong into one of the figures. A squeal of feedback. The static doubled in volume, but she felt no actual body inside the cloak. It collapsed as she pushed through it like a curtain between rooms. Hopping down into the pit, she put her arm around John Peters, who was oblivious to anything but his fear. She dragged his stiff, resistant body to the edge, pulled him up, and, with the help of a waiting Carlos, moved him back through the gap in the ring to the sun-hot blacktop. John Peters was curled into a ball, his eyes and mouth distended, his only sound a seemingly endless, tremulous exhale.
"It's illegal to interfere with the hooded figures," said a voice full of authority.
Pamela Winchell stood over them, arms crossed.
"So arrest me."
Pamela narrowed her eyes, but made no move toward them. John Peters coughed, coming back to the world.
"Where am I? My God, what happened? I'm a farmer, in case anyone didn't know."
Nilanjana didn't have time for his shit, or Pamela's.
"You all right, John?" she asked, then, without waiting for an answer, "We good to leave?"
she asked Pamela, then, without waiting for an answer,
"Where's your car, Carlos?"
"I took the bus."
"Steve and Abby already got out of here," Nilanjana said. "Let me give you a ride home."
And they left.
"Thanks. This time of day, the city buses are covered in tarantulas," Carlos said on the way to her car. "They don't harass me or anything, but I'm always afraid of sitting on one or accidentally bringing one home if it crawls into my bag. I feel bad. The poor thing just wanted to get home from a long day. Next thing it knows, it's in my living room and Cecil and I are screaming."
"Scared of tarantulas?"
"Oh, not at all. Screaming, 'You're adorable!' and 'What's your name, cutie?'"
She pulled out of the parking lot. Behind her, Pamela got into her official government-issue car, a chrome and purple PT Cruiser. As she followed, she spoke into her wrist, where she did not appear to have any sort of microphone or radio. Nilanjana was still put off by a lot of Night Vale's strangeness, but she had gotten used to being tailed by government agents, so she took the moment to fill Carlos in on her time at the church.
"And so, the church believes it is an actual giant centipede that will one day lift itself through the earth and eat everyone," she finished.
"Fascinating. I hope it's true."
"Why would you hope that?"
"Because in most religions, the deities don't physically exist, or there is no proof of their existence. It makes it difficult to scientifically study these beings that claims are being made about. If this joyous congregation is worshiping a corporeal being, there is a chance that we could study their god."
"The giant centipede."
"Centipedes are extremely scientific."
"How about we kill it first and study it later?"
"No," Carlos said, his voice unusually hard and decisive. "Absolutely not. We can't kill a living thing just because we're afraid of it, or even because we want to study it. A dead thing has less data than a living thing, even if that data is easier to access. We don't even know the first thing about the way it lives. Is it alone? Are there others?"
"Let's hope not."
"What does it eat?"
"According to the church, everything. The entire world."
"Doubtful. How does a beast, even a large one, devour everything in the world?"
"Very carefully?"
Carlos nodded seriously. He had trouble understanding when something was a joke.
"It would have to be done carefully, yes."
"Carlos, if that thing's real, It's going to devour the whole town before you get done writing one page of observations. If we want to talk scientific value, let's talk about how it's way easier to do good research when you're alive and not inside an insect. Actually, an insect has only 6 legs. You know what I meant.